We'll start off by talking about angels, actually, before, and then come back to the picture and the exercise we've been doing. The word angel comes out of Hebrew originally. It's a word meaning malak, which is a word called malak, which means messenger. Now, angels are these very focused beings. You find them all over the world. They're called in the East. They're called the Devas, the shining ones. But in Judeo-Christian tradition, Judeo-Christian and Persian tradition, really, they are these beings who are these intermediaries between the divine and the human. So they are these messengers moving back and forth between, if you like, the place of complete stillness and presence, and where the sort of immediate physicality of here and there. Now, most of our common vision images of angels come out of Victorian. Victorians got very into angels. And as with most things of Victorians, they sentimentalized them. So you get these Victorian images of angels leading little children by the hand, or kind of weeping with people who are sad you also, I suppose, also much earlier, in the Renaissance, you get the Baroque angels appear. So where you get the chubby cherubs, the kind of the image of angels is used a lot. It's used hugely in art in the sort of Art Nouveau period, you get these beautiful, rather beautiful Art Nouveau angels that are more focused in their lines and artistic expression. But if we go back to the original idea of angels and the descriptions of angels, they're these very peculiar beings. So if you look at the vision of Ezekiel, what turns up are angels who are these geometric shapes, winged wheels with hundreds of eyes. Or the angels called the Keot HaKadesh, the holy living creatures, who are formed out of, they are a combination of lion, of ox, of eagle, and human being. Or they're seraphim, who are faces with six great wings coming out of them. If you notice, they look a bit like starfish. If you've been Wells Cathedral, look at the front of the cathedral, you'll see seraphim, and they just look like a massive starfish. There's a face with these huge wings shooting out. So they're quite surreal kind of beings, and they're surreal because they're sort of embody an archetypal idea. Angels are said not to have free will. They have they do the will of the being that sends them, of the divine that sends them. So there's a brilliant film called Dogma, great comedy film. It's got a wonderful film to watch. If you haven't watched it, I really recommend it. Because you've got these two angels who have somehow got a bit stranded on Earth, and they've found that there's some loophole in Catholic theology, where there's a door opened once every 7 years, and if they can find a way back through the door, they can get back into heaven. And they're trying to work out how to do that, but the writer really portrays the nature of angels very well, because they're very literal. So one of the angels is an angel of divine vengeance, and who punishes sinners, And one of the little difficulties that happens in this film along the way is if people take the name of the Lord in vain by saying, oh, Jesus, or something like that, he considers it as his duty to kill them because they have blasphemed, and it's his job to kill blasphemers. And obviously it's a funny thing, so it's not a literal thing, but what, when you encounter angels, you encounter presences that have directionality. So an angel that is an angel of clarity isn't something you want when you want softness and kindness. You want an angel of kindness. The original, before the pre-Christian, pre-Judaic, these figures get called daemons, not demons. They get later translated into demons by the Christian church. Daemons are these intermediary beings whose role it is to connect, the non-dual divine place with the human place. And there's various schemas, really, for understanding angels. The various so the Tree of Life has its own set of angels, or the Christian Church has its own way of categorizing angels. And basically, it's categorizing archetypal energies. So, for example, the angels that come from the deepest source, come from Keter, the crown of the tree, are called the Keot HaKadesh. These are the highest angels or deepest angels. They are the holy living creatures and said of the holy living creatures that they come and they go. They go from the source to the everyday world, and then they immediately return to that place. So they act as a sort of a living link between the deepest part of ourselves and the most outer part of ourselves. And they are reflected, the angels of Malkut, which are the most outer part, are called the Cherubim, the strong ones. And they have also the same kind of quality. They both have this image, they both are connected with this image of the bull, of the eagle, the lion, and the human face. That's because they represent the four root qualities of the elements. And so the lion is fiery, the ox is of earth, the human being is of air, and rather oddly, the eagle is of water. That's because the eagle these are the fixed signs of the zodiac, where the eagle is Scorpio. And the white eagle is the sort of is regarded as the higher aspect of Scorpio. It doesn't really matter. You don't have to hang on to those images, but the idea of it is those angels somehow incorporate or bring together these qualities of the four elements, which we can find in the ordinary things of earth, air, water, fire. These elements of life. Which you can find that at the most outer level, but it says actually these come out of roots that come right in from the deepest parts of ourselves. Now, let's come back to the Tree of Life and remember this idea, this friend. Okay, so let's remember that the basis of the Tree of Life, right? Which comes out of these three circles that link things together. So angels are, if you like, part of the underpinning, these kinds of energies of connection. Now, if I just sun dry on this other one, come back to the circular diagram in a moment, but the one I'm sending right now is generated, comes out of the circular diagram, but we'll come back to that underpinning. Because what you see in the circular, in the next diagram, are the paths of connection between things. Now, these two diagrams are ways of helping us make connections between the inside and the outside, essentially. Now, Malkuth, which is this place just down at the bottom, which is the outermost place, is normally called the world of Asiya, the world of action. Don't have to know the Hebrew, it doesn't matter. It's the world of action and substance. And it's the outermost place. And it connects into the sort of world of fragmentation, the world that Kabbalists call the Klipot, the world, so the world outside. So in a sense, the boundary of Malkuth is the boundary of your body. But not just your body, then it's the world that you perceive through your body. So if we're looking outward from Malkuth, we're looking out, when we're present in our bodies, we connect to the living tree of life, so we start to make a shift, but often we're not. Right, so when we're not, we don't have any sense of any innerness at all. We're just caught in this kind of outer world, which is the world the Kabbalists tend to call the world of the Klipot, the world of fragments, the world where nothing feels connected. It's really crazy making. But as we start to connect, with our bodies, we can get present there, what happens is we start to become aware we start to become present to ourselves and start to become aware of the subjective universe, the world inside, our thoughts, our feelings. And this is all organized around this place called the moon. I mean, in Hebrew it's Yesod, the foundation of life. Now, in this place, which is, we could call it, it's a place of our conditioned imagination, it's also where our instinctual drives and life energy is. But it's also that this is the, if you like, the fulcrum around which the first level of our subjectivity is organized. So it's our conditioned sense of self, our conditioned sense of world. It takes in the sphere around this, takes in our mind and our feelings, and also touches into that deeper sense of stillness and presence at the top of the arc. But we're often not very connected to that deeper part of the arc because of this secondary spin that goes on between thought and feeling and memory and conditioned imagination. So although it's being described as a sort of circle, it's much more like a tangle with these things bouncing back and forth and occasional contacts with the body. And if we were going to depict that accurately, it would be like a huge tangle that entangles the body as well, so that's constantly sort of in movement. And so anyway, those of us who are therapists, this is normally the state that somebody comes to see when in a real mess, bouncing back and forth. But what's interesting as you sort of often inquire, you know, either yourself or with somebody else into this tangle, it often feels very random, but actually there are repetitive patterns going on inside it. That are closed loops that just keep repeating themselves endlessly. Now, as we deepen our sense of kind of connection and get more and more present, what starts to happen is we start to become, this tangle starts to clear for moments, and you start to touch some of the deeper aspects of our nature. You start to feel a sense of presence, sense of center. So this, the sphere at the top of that arc, right at the center of this diagram, the sphere of the sun, it represents presence, feeling a bit, and center and heart, being at the heart of things. And the more, in a way, we connect to these things, this deeper thing, the more the tangle starts to clear itself, and this other wheel starts to kick in. So where the sort of sense of presence and the wheel based on presence starts to affect our imagination, it starts to affect our feelings, it starts to affect our mind. So what starts to happen is that the, if you like, the sunlight of the light of the sun starts to illuminate the unconscious conditioned imagination and memory. So it starts to bring a presence into that kind of pool. They often give the image of a pool for the sphere of the moon, where it can be all very, you know, so a pool can be clear and can show beautiful images or reflect, or it can be all turbid and reflect dark imaginings. So there's an energy of clarification that starts to happen as the sun shines into the pool, is that image. But the other thing that happens is that Mercury starts to connect up with this deeper sphere called Mars. So the mind starts to become focused and disciplined. That kind of clarity of the warrior energy that you get from Mars, that's focus, and starts to, instead of the mind just bouncing all over the place, starts to acquire a bit of focus and direction. Similarly, on the other side of the equation, the feeling nature, instead of just being very reactive, starts to open into this sphere of love and compassion and kindness. And so there's a sense of the opening of our feelings, first of all, often in a sense of self-compassion and of acceptance. And our feeling nature is somewhere being opened up into a wider kind of field. Now, as that happens, and as we sort of remain sort of centered there, we actually start to touch even deeper places. We touch this third sphere, which is organized around the idea of mystery and unknowing. And as we can learn to tolerate and to enter into beyond the sense of feeling present, touching the really deeper places of Anuvin, we then start to touch on the source of our being and these two primal energies, the primal feminine, the primal masculine, which is the deep imagination and the deep will. And these places start to work on the energies of clarity and compassion and Mercury and Venus and Moon. And so you get this realignment of the whole of the tree. Now, this act of realignment, these movements, the messengers that come out of these deep archetypal places are what the Kabbalists would say are the angels. These are focused presences moving along specific paths to do a particular job. Now, the Kabbalists would say that the first sphere is the sphere of gods. They would go to theistic in their orientation. So then they have these names of God that are about the being nature. And then they say, well, okay, and under the being nature, there are these beings called archangels, and then there are angels. So it's a little nested hierarchy. So there's the place of being, which is a place of stillness, divinity, which you would place in source. Then there would be the place of archangels, which actually come out of the Saturn and the stars place, the place of creativity. So archangels are these beings that are creative beings. and have, to a certain extent, their own individuality, their own distinct presence. And underneath them, which is the kind of all the rest of the spheres, is you have the choirs of angels. And the phrase choirs of angels, because angels are not very differentiated. They are like messengers, like matrices, like patterns in the way that William, as William explained, they're just there to do a job. And the job is to carry out the will of the archangel, which is expressing the being nature of the divine energy that is at the heart of the archangel. Now, each of the spheres of the tree has a name of God, an archangel, and a choir of angels. And then the final bit of it is a physical object that represents the quality of that archetypal energy in the universe. Now, the physical objects are the things that we've got written down in this other diary. So you've got the planets, so you've got the Earth, the Moon, Mercury and Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, fixed stars, and this not very physical object they call the first movement, the primum mobile. Now, in practice, we don't have to get too hung up on any of this. It's a whole a lot of this is the product of medieval thinking. Medievals like to make lots of lists, right? And they really loved hierarchy. The more important idea is the idea that angels are this presence or archetypal presence that comes out of the stillness, that they have a shape and directionality. Now, in practice, what we mostly work with, and certainly in the work that I do, are the four archangels. So you have this figure of Raphael, who's in the east, Michael in the south, Gabriel in the west, Uriel in the north. And then the image of the human being standing in the middle, connecting all the different levels. So if we come to the alchemical diagram, which we're going to use in different ways, what we have, we've got the four archangels on the outside, under the images of fire, air, water and earth. They sort of represent the four directions and the idea of, and the idea of squareness, right? So there's something about, because actually the if you look at that diagram, what we have there is it's a diagram of squaring the circle. Opposites. So we put together opposites. So we bring together the squareness and the shape of the square together with the sphere. Now, if you just look at the table in the middle of the room for a moment, this table was chosen very specifically because it's a circular table, but it has, if you notice, it's got four legs. It also has the six petaled roses, because the other image you'll see is the... Because it connect. Because the idea of the table is that it's circular and it's square. So it's four and it's a circle. It's also got this image of the six petal roses, which represent the union of up and down. They're two It's like a star of David. So there's two triangles. You'll notice in the alchemical diagram, we've got the central figure holding the Star of David, and either side of that figure we've got holding an upward triangle and a downward triangle. Because there again we're looking at not just the opposites of across the circle, but the opposites of up and down. In the diagram, we've also got the opposites of in and out, because we've got people sitting on top of the mound, and we've got a cutaway section to show people in the mound. We've also got a tree growing up into space, and we've got a well going down into the ground. Now, if we look at the meditation that we did, we start working first of all with a sense of in and out. Okay, we come into our sense of our bodies, we get present in our senses, and we move from the outside to the inside. So that's, if you like, that's the first set of polarities that we look at. And we, in a certain sense, partly because of the kind of work that we're doing, we're bringing the outside into the inside. So we sort of fold inwards. And we move down. But as we move down, we find something rising up to meet us. So again, we're starting to work with this image of the central axis of things, of opposites coming together. As we go down, something comes up. So this... And what we worked with in our meditation is the idea of sanctuary, of the idea of creating a space. It's the same image as the chalice. We create sanctuary. The word sanctuary is the place that is sanctified, the place that is holy. It comes from the Hebrew kadosh. Kadosh, and kadosh means the place that is whole, the place that can hold, the place that has wholeness. It's another version of the vessel. So the sanctuary is another version of the grail vessel. So we create a form around us. The sanctuary arises up out of the depth. And then we have a similar movement as we rise up with that energy. We're met by another sanctuary coming down from the heights, which then comes together. So the height and the depths come together and form the kind of vessel. But the next thing that we do then is then invite the four archangels in to hold and potentize the vessel. So they are simultaneously part of the holding frame, but they're also the energy that creates the field, the kind of creative field. Because the Archangel Raphael brings in this sense of the breath, newness, beginnings. Michael brings in fire, that kind of fire of purification. Gabriel brings in the water of purification, and Uriel brings in this energy of being the alchemist, being the person who holds it all in awareness. Now, the getting to know the and then what happens is that we're just sort of in it. We're holding the, because then we come into this, because then in the meditation we came into the center of the meditation, contemplating the bowl, contemplating the pool, contemplating the fire, contemplating it and its reflection. So we stand in the middle, being the alchemist, or being the center point of it all, but holding while being held by all the things that have been invited in. So we're creating a sort of a matrix, really. And then all we do is we're just quiet, we're just still. So then we just relax into the stillness. And, you know, we sat in stillness for a really kind of long time, just being with all of that, because that's when the kind of alchemy starts to happen. And partly because of the timing and where we were at a certain point, then I was sort of prompted to bring us into relationship with Remembrance Sunday and that kind of energy. Now the archangels are these kind of vast kind of beings, but they can also be tiny. They can be anything they want to be. They can be tiny. They can be vast. They are but they do. They hold this particular creative kind of field, and they've got their own qualities. So, the archangel Raphael is often talked about as being the healer, and as being connected with breathing new life into things. And in particular, bringing this energy of the dawn and the new day. and healing the wounds of the past. The Archangel Michael is this energy of fire and light and illumination, and sometimes called the archetypal priest who brings the divine fire, brings enlightenment. The Archangel Gabriel is to do with the energies of water and reflection, vision, image. While the Archangel Uriel is this kind of this light within darkness, this kind of bringing opposites together, creative, mysterious kind of energy that brings about transformation. Also the Angel of Death. And the idea of death creating new life. And the four of them together form a mandala, with the human being in the center, connecting the height and the depth. So they're these great archetypal energies, really, that create a sort of a form that is both stable and creative. So it creates this kind of, this idea of sanctuary, this idea of wholeness. And all you have to do then is to be in that, present in it, in entering into the stillness of that, and letting that field kind of do its work. So that, in a way, is the created alchemical vessel, right, and the practice. But then the question is, well, what goes into the practice? What's it for? What do we, you know? So we've created the form, and we'll do that this afternoon in small groups. So, but then it's what to put into the vessel. Now, as I said yesterday, it could be anything. Anything can come into this vessel. It can be a personal issue. It can be a collective issue. But basically, what we're doing is creating, in a sense, a contained vessel with our awareness, with our presence, with the help of the angels, so that the Esh Meseraf, the purifying fire, the fire that is like water, or the fiery water, can work on something called the prima materia, the first matter. Now, I will give you a copy of this book probably next month. It's a bit of a nightmare. Alchemical texts are nightmares because they're designed to be explained. If you try to read them, they're one of the most irritating things. So I didn't want to give it to you until I've explained it a bit, because it'll just look like crazy things stuff. They're very concentrated, and they are coming out, and they're also coming out of a 16th century mindset as well. So Esh Meseraf is a alchemical work based upon the Tree of Life. So that's why I'm kind of using this particular. There's lots of others that we could use, but it's quite useful because it actually uses a symbolism and an imagery of the Tree of Life, unlike some of the others. And it starts off by mentioning the prophet Elisha. And Elisha is one of these wild man figures of the Bible. He's like the prophet Elijah. He's a sort of the classic prophet in Judaic times. He turns up and challenges the king and tells everybody how corrupt they are and stirs everything up. Now he's a sort of green man figure in terms of British culture. He's this wild man who comes out of the hills, and who does and represents that kind of creative energy. Now in this book he's used as the image of the alchemist. So, you know, you get a lot of alchemical images of these kind of guys studying books and in their laboratories, and whereas the image that's given here is a bit different. Elisha is this creative, kind of potent, kind of mischievous kind of being who comes out of the wilderness. His name is interesting as well. It's in Elisha in Hebrew is Aleph Lamed Shin Vav, which and you can separate into two phonemes. The name Aleph Lamed is one of the most ancient of Middle Eastern god names. The god El, is before the Jews came along, is the high god of the Canaanites. So the name El represents actually a name of God. Shinvah is Shua. It represents the salvation or the transformation by the god El. So the god El. So Elisha's name. This is his nature. Then the name defines nature in these old texts. This is the being who brings the transformation or the salvation of the god El. Now, what is the god El? It's the old high god of the Canaanites. It's the divine source. But actually, it's the two words Aleph Lamed mean the ox and the ox goad. Now, a Middle Eastern person, if you have an image of an ox and an ox goad, what it takes you to fairly immediately is the idea of irrigation, because you have this, you have the ox walking around the water wheel, being prodded by the ox goad, in order to bring water out of the ground. The other thing that you have with the name, the letter Shin, which is prominent in this name, so you've got this image of water coming out of the ground. Right? The next letter that you have in the name is the letter Shin, which is the letter of fire. And the final letter Vav is a letter that connects things. So if we were to look at analyze the name of Elisha, we have this image of water and fire, the irrigation of water and the rising of fire and the transmission of a message. So right at the beginning of the book Esh-Meserev, the book of the purifying fire, the art of the purifying fire, we're given an image of an ideal alchemist who's this intuitive wild creature out of the hills, whose nature is like fire and water and has a message to deliver. And it says Elisha is a most notable prophet, an example of natural wisdom, a despiser of riches. Now this is an alchemical text. It's quite significant. Natural wisdom, what the alchemist said, that natural wisdom is that the alchemy is the wisdom of nature. Lady Alchemia is the energy of nature, the natural process applied in consciousness and in awareness. So he is an example of natural wisdom. So they're saying, look, he's an example of this by tuning into nature, by being like the green man who attunes to the elements, attunes to the energies of nature. He has acquired this natural wisdom. He is a despiser of riches. Now, this is a kind of flip really at the people who think alchemy is about creating gold. So it's not about creating gold. And it goes on to say, as the history of the healing of Naaman shows. Now Naaman is a story in the Bible of Naaman, the warrior of Syria, who comes to Elisha for healing because he's got leprosy. And Elisha heals him. And he wants to give him loads of riches, and Elisha refuses. So we're saying we're being reminded of the figure of Naaman and the fact that Elisha doesn't want to accumulate lots of gold. But it goes on to say that the true physician of impure metals. Now this is the we're looking at the tree of life in the body in the earth. Now, what the alchemists do when they look at the archetypes of the Tree of Life, they look at the Tree of Life these archetypes as metals embedded in the earth. So we're looking at metals as archetypal energies. So we're looking into the body, into the earth, and as the we're looking at the inside of the mound in a way. And we're looking at the bottom part of the circle, where you find the planets and the sun inside the earth, inside the mound. The figure in the figures in the mound represent the energies of the elements. You've got the figure playing the lyre is the sun in the middle of the earth, with the six planets. The six planets around, seventh planet, of course, being the earth itself. So immediately what this text is saying is, as you go inside, you find the energies of the tree of life like metals embedded in the earth. Impure metals. Impure because they are mixed up with everything else. They're like veins. They run through the earth. They're entangled with all kinds of things. And it says, it goes on to say, the true physician of the impure metals hath not an outward show of riches, but is like the tohu of the first nature, empty and void. Which word, the word tohu, has the same number as the word Elisha? Now, in Hebrew, letters are also numerals. When a word has the same number as another word, they believe it has an identity. The two functions have an identity. The word tohu means emptiness or voidness or stillness. The word Elisha has the same number as that, as the word tohu. And that tohu isn't just a sort of ordinary kind of stillness. It's the stillness before creation. It's the silence out of which activity arises. So what's being said to us is that if you want to become somebody who can be an alchemist, who can transform the impure metals, the archetypes that are all tangled together, which is the tangle that we're talking about here, right? This is then you have to be like Elisha, and you have to be not attracted to the surface, not into the outward show. You have to be, and you have to go somewhere back to the beginning of things, into the tohu of the first nature. You have to become empty and void. You have to enter into a stillness. And it is a true saying, and there's something called Baba Kama, which is the sayings of the Judaic fathers, that the thing which causes riches, such as natural wisdom, is supplied instead of riches. So instead of gaining, you know, just grabbing external benefits and sort of selling your art, if in a sense, and thereby somehow losing your art, you're given the thing that is creative, that takes you from the place of needing something from the outside to it arising from within, from the creative matrix inside you. Learn therefore to purify Naaman, who coming from the north out of Syria, and acknowledge the power of Jordan, the river of judgment flowing out of the north. Now, that takes us into the core process of the whole book. Because Naaman, as an archetypal image, is the warrior of Syria. Got this one on my. Yes, I'm cool. Is the warrior of Syria, who represents our own will. He's this warrior-like figure with a sword. And his problem is he's got leprosy. Now, what he represents in a way the corroded and fixated will that's tangled up in the tangle of our conditioning. Now, leprosy is an illness of desensitization. The reason why people get sores and injure themselves and their bodies can get very hard is because they lose sensitivity in the pain receptors. So people cannot tell when they're hurting themselves. And so very often you get sores and infections. And it's an illness also that where boundary gets broken. So it somewhere represents the fact that our will has become tangled and corroded and it isn't supple, isn't fluid. And also that somehow our vehicle of containment, in which our ability to contain our energies and to hold our energies has become broken. Now, so we have this image of this part of ourselves, which somewhere does represent the deep will, but instead of that will being in relationship with things and able to move appropriately to whatever conditions it meets, our will, our intentionality is somehow trapped. And in that trappedness, it can't respond appropriately to things. And therefore, we become hurt, we become abraded, our sovereignty gets taken away from us, and we become invaded by other organisms. We become infected. And that infection, it destroys our capacity to act, to be present, to be aligned. Now, what Elisha does, what happens in a way, as we become, as this part of ourselves, so if you like this, and in a way, when we perform a meditation, or when we bring ourselves present, or try to, we're bringing our will, our intentionality, into relationship with that deeper place. Why do we meditate? Well, I meditate because I feel better. Or because I know it's good for me. It's a bit like I'm bringing that my inner man into relationship with this deeper kind of place, in the hope of growing, in the hope of changing, in the hope of something different happening to me. In that moment, I'm like the man wanting healing, wanting my leprosy to be cured. And the River Jordan is very potent kind of image, really, in the Middle East. And again, at the time this is written, the 16th century, you can't think about the River Jordan without thinking of not just of this biblical story, but of Christ's baptism in the River Jordan. Great archetypal image of Christ becoming Christ by being baptized by John the Baptist in the Jordan, and you've got this great image, not only of the Jordan go right in the middle of the river. The Jordan is said to connect the Red. It doesn't literally do this, but in the mythical image, it connects the Red Sea and the Salt Sea. So it's the river that connects the opposites. It also connects the east and the west. East bank of the Jordan, west bank of the Jordan. It runs north south. So you're putting yourself into the mandala of the angels, in a way. The other thing that you have is Christ is plunged downwards into the waters and brought up. And so there's this descent and a rising, and equally there's a rising that's met by the descent of the Holy Dove. Mm. And the dove is a bit like the energy of the hour, and it's the alchemizing energy, it's the divine breath coming down and consecrating Christ. So we get this double image in this book of the Old Testament image of the healing of Naaman, which inevitably reminds the reader of the baptism of Christ. So it's saying that this book is all about the healing of this deep part of ourselves, and that healing of this deep part of ourselves is like the baptism of Christ in the Jordan by John the Baptist. What happens in that moment is that the alchemist, who in this case, if you like, in the Jesus story is John the Baptist, I guess, in the Naaman story is Elisha, is placing the Naaman, or placing the Jesus figure, in the center of the mandala, in the center of the flow, that connects the opposites, and just being still with them in that place. And in that place, something then happens. The leprosy goes away. Christ becomes Christ. Something mysterious happens through that kind of process of immersion and meeting, and a meeting of all the opposites coming together in the contained vessel of stillness. And that's what we did this morning, right? That's the practice that we did. It's the same practice we did yesterday in a less kind of ritual way. Okay, that's what we've been doing. It is a process of creating sanctuary. First of all, in our bodies, just in ourselves. And then in the field around us, and then later extending that field into different parts of the world. Just to finish on this bit, and then we'll do some practical stuff after lunch. And they says, remember what is said in Baba Bhatra, these great news. Baba Bhatra is another collection of sayings. He that will become wise, let him live in the south. He that will grow rich, let him turn himself to the north. Although in the same place, Rabbi Joshua ben Levi says, let him live always in the south, for whilst he becomes wise, at the same time he becomes rich. So actually, it's about connecting connecting the north and the south, not separating the outside richness from the inside wisdom. Connect the two together. And then there's a quote from the book of Proverbs: "Length of days is in her right hand, and in her left hand riches and honor." It's an invocation of Sophia, who is the feminine wisdom figure in the Bible. So they flip, these little things come in, because actually what's being talked about here is the divine feminine, which who is literally the mater, the mother, the matrix of the form, and in the Hebrew tradition, the creation comes about by the sort of divine presence and holy wisdom creating the universe together. So it's an aspect, so maleness and femaleness together creating the universe. And so what the book is saying is that this inner work that you're doing connects you to the beginnings of creation, connects you to the divine presence, El, and holy wisdom. The other thing that just next to that verse in Proverbs is a verse which talks about the rain, the dew falling from heaven, and the fountain of the abyss opening up and being unsealed. So we're constantly given these images opposite. This is left hand, right hand. Next verse, next verse in the Bible, the waters descend, the rain comes down, the fountain of the abyss opens up. So we're constantly being shown these two energies coming together, left horizontally coming together, vertically coming together. So this is the sort of, this is the practice really. And it's actually much simpler to do than to talk about it. As we talk about it, it starts to sound quite complicated, but actually doing it is very straightforward. And then this final, just end on this bit. Know that the mysteries of this wisdom do not differ from the mysteries of the Kabbalah. for the same as the consideration of the predicaments of holiness is the same as the conditions of impurity. The same sefirot which are in Atzulit, the same are in Asiya. This is the image of the Atzulit is the divine source, Asiya is just here. So it ends by just saying, this kind of work is the same as this holy work that is called the Kabbalah. And the same, and if you, though you're working on the outer, you're also working on the deepest inner. It's the same thing. So there we have it. That's the beginning of the book. It's not even the first chapter. Yeah. It's a very concentrated book. We're going to keep visiting it through the year. Partly because it just holds the heart of what we're doing, but also hopefully also want to teach you the ways to read alchemical texts or these kind of texts, because they're normal. The thing is, we have access to hundreds of manuscripts now. In the days when these things were written, you'd have this and this. You'd have the Bible and this. So the alchemist would be working on these two things, have access to nothing else. Right, so they're written in very concentrated ways, and they're not, and where people had the time and the attention to really kind of study them. And in a sense, it's pretty much, we'll be doing this pretty much what we did with the poem, and also seeing they're quite different dialects, but there's a lot of similarities between the two things. Anyway, let's have some lunch and come back at